the spring of 2016, the people of my home planet, Kerber Thursleken, decided to conduct an experiment. Three humans from the planet Earth, Dan, Mike, and Jesse, were abducted. In order to study their culture, we forced them to discuss a highly varied selection of topics ranging from pop culture to the paranormal. We are beginning to regret this. Welcome to Podcast 1289's first annual Halloween Spooktacular. Today's experiment, Murder in Our Town. Joining Dan, Mike, and Jesse today are John, Chef Bagels, and special guest star, Grant.
So, today I was walking around Walmart, right, and for some fucking reason, I just started singing Nine Inch Nails in Alan Jackson's voice.
Oh my god!
So I'm just like, I'm like going up, you know, grabbing fucking Tide, going, "Bow down before the one you serve. Get what you deserve." Walking around like, "I wanna fuck you like an animal. I wanna feel you from the inside, baby. My whole existence is flawed. You bring me closer to God."
Can I get an amen?
I was in a liquor store with Stefan, and an Alan Jackson song came on, and Stefan just looks at me and goes, "This guy sounds like what a Slim Jim tastes like."
Oh, wow, that's good.
Grease and nitrates.
And mechanically separated meat.
You could sing, like, Atrocity Exhibition or, like, really any song off of, like, Closer. People would think you're just being Ian Curtis.
That's a dark fucking album.
That is, like, one of the darkest things I've ever heard, and this is me talking. Like, I'm the guy who listens to Ligeti for fun.
John's not joking either. I remember being, like, eighth grade going over to John's house. And him be like, "Come here, I wanna show you this album," and puts this fucking CD in, and it's just like for like 90 minutes, and I'm like, "What the fuck was that?" He's like, "This is a Philip Glass piece about the people that died in Hiroshima."
that was the Penderecki piece.
Yes. Now Penderecki has had, like, if you listen to any Penderecki track, you're like, "Oh, this is The Shining, isn't it?" And it's like, well, yes, they used some of his pieces in that. So imagine being in eighth grade and, like, your best friend is like, "Here, I want you to check out this really cool CD," and puts on, like, The Shining music, and you're just like,
I should probably make friends with this guy so that when they discover all the skin suits, I'm not one of them.
Oh, that was good. Well done, Mike. Well done. Fucking nailed it. All right. Welcome to Podcast 1289.
Where all of your sexy Penderecki dreams come true.
Yo, for high class motherfucking Penderecki references, you got to go down to Podcast 1289.
Yeah.
Yo, what else would sound ridiculous in Alan Jackson's voice?
Gigi Allen.
Gigi Allen? What's a good Gigi Allen song?
Cunt-sucking cannibal.
I'm a filthy fucking animal. My body stinks. I ain't got no teeth.
I knew that would work well.
Fucking animal.
That's fucking David Allen
Coe song. Welcome to a podcast 1289, everyone.
I'm a filthy fucking pig. Loaded a dive.
I piss in a bottle and I shit in a bag.
So, what are we talking about today?
I drank gin bean till I piss in the bed.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm a self-destructive slob, bleeding all the time. Come on.
Come on.
Man, just do all Naked right. City in that voice.
No, we're done with Alan Jackson for now.
Gigi Allen Jackson.
Art plus doom equals fun. Can we actually, Jesse, we have to just do that. It's country versions of Gigi Allen songs.
A new character for the fucking show is Gigi Allen. Jackson. G.G. Allen Greenspan. Dr. G.G. Allen Grant, the whole helicopter ride of Jurassic Park, he's just cutting his chest with a razor and shitting himself. You'll have to excuse Dr. Grant.
And yeah, there's just kind of a still shot of like Goldblum kind of looking at him with like this look of like,
wow. That is one big pile of shit.
What are we doing?
God, I don't know. I wouldn't mind for a Halloween episode just doing 30 minutes of G.G. Allen fucking Greer. I don't know.
G.G. Allen Greer.
G.G. Allen Dick.
Oh, Jesus.
G.G. Allen Rickman. I'm a filthy fucking animal. My body stinks. I ain't got no teeth. G.G. Allen Poe. That'd be pretty cool, actually. That'd be like a death rock G.G. Allen. Like if G.G. Allen did fucking black metal, that'd be pretty cool. G.G. Allen Iverson.
After every layup, he fucking cuts what? Himself.
G.G. Allen Ginsberg. All right, welcome everybody to another edition of Podcast 1289. As always, I'm one of your many hosts. I'm Jesse. Tonight, we've got Dan in the house.
Hey, everybody.
We've got classically home-style Mike.
Hello.
Then, special guests. We've got everybody's favorite nihilist, except for Herzog, of course. We got John, people.
You know, eventually that, like, aside is going to turn into, like, a...
It's just going to keep degenerating like a Cosby clone.
It's going to degenerate and start corrupting into just kind of, like, random vowels.
It's eventually going to be a grunt.
Then we've got back with us, we've got Chef Bagels.
What's cooking, everybody?
No, I
don't care how much you guys hate it.
First things first, we want to thank everyone that's been spreading the word on Twitter, on Facebook, everyone over in the Pottern family, and a big shout out to Secret Transmission for all the love they've been giving us and the awesome crossover episode that we did with them. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, go over to Secret Transmission's page and you'll hear us utterly, savagely tear apart the Area 51 Coast to Coast AM caller. So, tonight, on a very special Halloween episode of Podcast 1289, we're talking about hometown murderers, folks.
The seedy past of our allegedly quiet hometowns. Like, I had no idea that mine happened until you brought it to my attention last week.
Yeah, you were originally going to do the Judds murdering the fucking music industry, but...
Billy Ray Cyrus murdering ponytails.
This from Ashland?
Yeah, I've met him before.
Ew!
I was working in the Ashland Plaza Hotel. I'm getting off of work, I get into the elevator, and there's three other people... Yeah, I know, it's a shithole.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I'm just picturing the fucking hotel from Home Alone 2 Lost in New York dumped in the middle of Squidbillysville.
Anyway, I get into the elevator, and there's three other people in there, and one of them is Billy Ray Cyrus. So as I close the door, I look him up and down, and I'm like, hey, you're Billy Ray Cyrus. And he goes, yeah. And I was just gonna leave it at that. And then he goes, do you want my autograph? And I went, no.
I feel really bad for Billy Ray Cyrus. He had to deal with this fucking bridge troll fucking making fun of a desire for a Billy Ray Cyrus autograph.
You know, you could be like, you could have been like a real asshole and said like, I loved you in Mulholland Drive. And then when he asked if you liked his albums, you could have been all like, wait, you do albums?
Billy Ray Cyrus was in fucking Mulholland Drive.
It was like the guy who like cheats with Justin Theroux's wife in like the middle.
How did Billy Ray Cyrus end up in a fucking David Lynch film? We're more qualified than him.
There's no fucking way he was in Mulholland Drive. I don't believe you at all. I'm googling it right now.
This is a fucking prank.
I'm googling it. Okay, he was. Yeah, there's a picture of him shirtless with a mullet. There we are.
Yep, that, right. Yep, that was the scene. Yep.
There's a lot of weird celebrity cameos sometimes. I mean, Mick Jagger was supposed to be in a Herzog movie, and
really?
Wouldn't Tom have been Cruise? Like the first time there's like a weird like celebrity cameo in like a David Lynch movie. I mean, fucking David Bowie shows up in like Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me for like no discernible reason.
Look, I can't stand David Bowie, but I at least acknowledge the fact that David Bowie is some sort of weird class of human where he could do fucking anything. And he'd be like, oh, well, it's David Bowie. You could go into, like, the Polish pork store, and fucking David fucking Bowie is making tube sausage. Like, well, you know, fucking David Bowie does this shit, you know?
Yeah.
Would you like a quarter pound of blood sausage?
You know, it's not really that one of my eyes is a separate color. It's just it's always dilated. Why is David Bowie giving me David Bowie trivia at the pork store in Linden, New Jersey? You know, my name is actually David Jones, but because of the monkey, I changed my name. No, I gotta go.
So do I. And that's when he, like, teleports. Like, on to my next gig.
Like, smoke begins rising from, like, beneath him, and he's just gone.
So let's get to it. Who wants to go first?
All right, I'll go first because mine's short.
Was it about the time you killed the Noid?
No.
Don't you fucking touch my pizza.
I saw Mike fucking beating the Noid to death behind a dumpster near Kennedy Park.
And so in the town where I grew up, there was a murder in 91. A 17-year-old girl was bludgeoned to death in the woods, and then her body was dumped behind a mini mall, probably about like a half a mile from my house. My mom actually worked in the mini mall above all the stores. They had like offices and stuff. And they didn't find the body for about a week because it was in the winter and there was a lot of snow. So the body was just like preserved. But she was 17 years old, and there was three other murders in the area that fit the description. Girl in their teens, walking home, snatched, beaten to death in the woods, and then dropped somewhere. Crazy story, because they picked up some drifter for one of the other murders, and it stuck. But all the other murders seemed to follow the same MO, and they were all done within like 6 months of each other. So
it's always the drifters. It's never like, you know, like,
hey man, you don't shit where you eat, all right?
I think you see some creepy guy with like greasy hair on the side of the road trying to hitchhike. You'd be like, nah, not today.
Yeah, do they really think that, like, who's going to pick him up? Like, another murderer is going to pick up that murderer.
What if it's just some sociopath in the town that just wants to stir shit up? It's just like, this might turn out to be an interesting week. Let me pick this guy up.
This guy looks respectable. I bet he has some firm opinions on things. Hey, who are you voting for? The ghost penis that lives in my mouth. Do you remember that one time I convinced you that me and my friend discovered a body?
Yeah, I do.
Hey, that's almost like the time that Mike convinced you he knew his way around New York.
Yeah, it almost got us murdered in Bed-Stuy.
We weren't almost murdered. Riley was almost murdered.
Oh,
the dudes that saw me and you, they were like, oh, some fat white crackers. Okay. And then they looked over at Riley and was like, a gay, skinny white cracker. He's wearing corduroy. Hit him in the face repeatedly.
Anyway, Jesse, you want to go or shall I?
You go first. Yours a heavy hitter.
Yeah, mine's a little, like, kind of in-depth. It's a bit of a long one, so I'll try to go through it quick. So, on Christmas Eve in 1881, so this is way before our time.
Speak for yourself. I'm immortal.
In Ashland, Kentucky, where I'm from, the townsfolk were awoke by someone shouting fire. And so what had happened was that there was a small frame house burning. So the townsfolk went outside and, like, was trying to help, and people ran inside to see if there was anyone in there, and they discovered three bodies, which they quickly removed to try to resuscitate. I don't know. They didn't have CPR in 1881, so I don't know what they were going to do.
Probably shouldn't have lynched the fire department.
It looks like he's pale and lost his path. Let's bleed him.
Rise, children.
Rise. Billy, witchdoctor.com.
Have one convenient location. In Africa.
So they pull them out to try to give them some semblance of medical aid or just to see if they're alive. And just as some physicians showed up, they announced that all three of the people had their skulls smashed in. So the dead were a pair of brothers and sisters, Robert Gibbons, age 17, and Fanny Gibbons, age 14, along with a neighbor friend, Emma Carlco, who was 15, who was keeping them company while their mother was in Ironton, Ohio, which is across the river with their other brother, Sterling, and would be gone until the next day. So Mrs. Gibbons had no idea that her family was dead for at least two more days. And then Mr. Gibbons, the father, he did a lot of work out of town. So he was the first suspect because he wasn't there. And he had also was completely unaware of what had happened to his family. He was located on New Year's Eve. So Christmas Eve is when it happened. New Year's Eve is when they found Mr. Gibbons. He was in West Virginia. They informed him and brought him back to Ashland, where he was exonerated. So could you imagine some fucking U.S. Marshal showing up and just like, hey, your family's dead. We got to make sure you're not the one that did it. Come back with me.
What a genius move that is. It's like he rides up on fucking horseback. He's like, hey, you need to come with me. We need to prove that you weren't here because it took me 3 days to get here to prove you were. Just come with me.
You were running an errand. That means you're suspect number one.
So,
are you Alan Jackson? Time-traveling Alan Jackson?
So, time-traveling Alan Jackson. So, they buried them.
G.G. Allen Keys. That's a fucking deep cut. Go on, sorry.
So, they buried them on the 26th, so 2 days later. And then, like, you know, it's a small town. People started to talk. People started to say, like, wonder what happened. Rumors were flying, all that. And then one such man, Mr. Powell, who owned a general store, made a comment to one of his regular customers, a fellow by the name of George Ellis, who was a local bricklayer, about Mr. Gibbons not being the suspect. And he, quote, wondered who it was going to fall on now. So Ellis was startled by this. The color drained from his face. He started to...
What was that? Did you guys hear that? It sounded like a girl screaming.
She probably just saw my face and she was like, ah!
You carnival face motherfucker. So anyway, Ellis was startled by this question and he blurted out that he may know who it might be. And then he like was talking to himself and Mr. Powell said he heard him say something about state's evidence before walking out the door to the general store. So Ellis, being paranoid, began to wander the street for hours and eventually made his way to the hotel room of a U.S. Marshal that was brought in to investigate. And after a brief introduction telling him, like, who he was and what he thought, like, may have happened, he asked the U.S. Marshal for the legal meaning of state's evidence, which, of course, means if you bring evidence to a case that helps in prosecution, then you get a lesser sentence.
If you're a fucking rat.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, it's like fucking Henry Hill at the end of Goodfellas.
Yeah, exactly. Your average nobody.
Hank Hill?
I'm your average schnook. We needed that Coke, Peggy.
So after hearing the definition and satisfied with what the explanation meant, he said he wanted to relieve his conscience by making a statement. So he started to confess. He implicated...
Fucking, you just go to Raceway Park or something?
Yes.
So he began to make a statement, and he implicated two other bricklayers, fellows by the name of William Neal and George Kraft. And then he gave this graphic explanation involving the premeditated raping of Fanny Gibbons, who was reported to be more physically developed, quote-unquote, for her age, and caught a lot of unwanted attention. And Ellis said that Neal said that he wanted to have carnal relations with her by Christmas. So Ellis explained that it was Kraft who wanted to do all this, with Neal and Ellis being brought along as aides. They murdered the family, the boy Robert, Fanny, and Emma, with an axe and a crowbar, respectively. I have Ellis's statement. A few evenings prior to the 24th, I met Kraft, who stated he was going to see Fanny Gibbons and take her some black candy. And then he was going to have intercourse with her, and he wanted me to come along. About midnight, the fatal night, we all started, Kraft, Neal, and myself, and we got to the house where Kraft raised the windows with an old axe and stepped in first. Neal followed, and I stayed behind on the porch, and afterwards I went in. Robbie was the first aroused and started to get up when Kraft said, "You had better lie still." Kraft then went to the bed where the two girls were sleeping and began to take improper liberties with them. Robbie said, "You'd better stay away from them," when Kraft hit him with an axe. He fell back on the lounge and then plunged forward and fell fully 6 feet from the bed under the stairs where he was found. The girls screamed when Kraft jumped onto the bed, and they both said, "George Kraft, what are you here for?"
How crazy would it be if this guy was somehow related to, like, the guy who invented Kraft cheese? There's just this weird little
just
nugget
murder
of information.
Cheese.
Yeah, and his cousin would also murder rape. Have some cheese.
Emma also started to jump from the bed when Neil choked her and pulled her onto the floor. She fought with him, and I held her while he outraged her. Neil then struck her in the head with the big end of the crowbar, and she instantly died after throwing her hands up. God. Kraft also had some trouble with Fanny Gibbons and called on me to come and help him. He then outraged her and then killed her. Neil proposed killing the girls, and after they were all dead, I took some coal oil, poured it over the bodies, and then set fire with a match.
Oh my God, is she all right?
Ellis would make several more confessions and then recant the earlier ones, and each one of these confessions was made to better fit the prevailing circumstances. So Kraft and Neil were immediately arrested and taken to the county jail. Once word got out that they had been in an arrest, a mob began to form and they wanted justice. So,
lynching time.
Yeah, a good old-fashioned lynch mob. So they planned to storm the jail and seize the three men and hang them. But the county judges and all that got wind of this and took them and sent them to Lexington for safekeeping. So on their way to Lexington, they took a steamboat down the Ohio River to Lexington. They made a stop off where a few reporters were allowed to board the vessel, where they then interviewed Kraft and Neil, who maintained their innocence. And Ellis was away from them, shackled away, and he didn't want to talk to anybody. Once in Lexington, Ellis stated that his first statement, the one that I read to you, wasn't true, and it was forced out by the U.S. Marshal under gunpoint as a way to, like, finish the case. So this was the first week of January. So January 16th, Kraft and Neil were brought back to Boyd County, where they were put on their first trial. February 6th of 82, so this is well over a month after everything. Neil was found guilty after 17 minutes of deliberation and sentenced to hang on Valentine's Day, 1882.
Valentine's Day. Bummer.
it gets better. A few days later, his boy toy, Kraft, was convinced and given the same fate, which they then appealed. And this became a long, drawn-out process of retrials and appeals and retrials. So Ellis again confessed and recanted at least half a dozen times, each with greater conviction. He had one where he claimed that he hired a pair of black men to commit the murders, and he alone raped and killed the girls while the hired men held them down.
Oh, man, dude, this isn't fucking Kentucky. You know, I think you'd get a higher sentence for giving a black person money than committing murder.
Jesus.
We paid two black men to do it. You did what?
This part of Kentucky is in the gray zone. It was, like, not necessarily the North, but not necessarily the South. But anyway.
I know plenty of racists in the North.
I know. No, I remember when I was in fucking school, they treated like everybody in the North were like not racist, peace-loving people that didn't like want anything to do with slavery.
Bullshit.
They believed that every man was equal. Every single fucking person in the North was this. And the South were like racist, violent motherfuckers.
That's true, but the North are too sometimes. The South is still a garbage fire, sorry, but...
It's true. So... Ellis went on trial. June 2nd of 82, he was found guilty and sentenced to life. And that night, around midnight, a group of 20 men stormed the jail and brought Ellis out. He was taken back to Ashland and hung from a sycamore tree about 100 yards away from the former Gibbons house. He met his fate calmly, and he made his final statements, maintaining that Kraft and Neil were guilty. His last requests were that his body wasn't mutilated.
And can I get one of them ice cream things, looks like a Ninja Turtle with the gumball eyes? That's my second to last request.
Please don't do nothing.
On your tombstone, pepperoni and... pineapple.
Don't you just love, by the way, that an American company used capital punishment to sell pizza?
Only in America. Anyway, where was I? Fuck. His official cause of death was ruled to have come at the hands of person or persons unknown. Going on with the other two, Kraft and Neil won a new trial. And most of the people in town considered the pair to be innocent, actually. Other than Ellis's testimony, there really wasn't much evidence and the two were becoming nationally famous. So this is like one of the like earlier times of a sensationalized news story like this. And they were offered a lecture tour, provided, of course, that they won their release.
A lecture tour? What are they going to lecture about?
I did not kill that girl. Newspaper correspondents would interview them regularly, whereupon they both expressed confidence that they would be released. But you know what? They still fucking executed them anyway, after many months of retrials and appeals, which included a riverboat chase being shot at by a mob that was trying to lynch both Kraft and Neil.
Isn't that the plot of Live and Let Die?
No, Fitzcarraldo. So, yeah, this was back at a time when the wheels of justice moved swiftly. They more or less commandeered a steamboat, and then the mob commandeered another steamboat, and then shot the shit out of the other guy's steamboat.
This is like a Porky's movie.
So, Neil and Kraft both maintained their innocence all the way to the gallows. Kraft was executed October 1883. So, almost a full 2 years after it happened. Kraft's last words were,
"I am now single
and ready to mingle. Swipe right on me, please."
God damn it.
At the gallows, he then sang a hymn, "Did Christ Die for Sinners Weep?" and then offered up a fervent prayer to God to save his soul.
And God was like, nope.
Then, all being prepared, he stepped onto the trap, weeping and crying, "Lord, receive my soul," and thus was sent on his way.
And then the Lord didn't, and he fucking died. The end.
Yeah. Before his execution, he met with a reverend who took him to the Little Sandy River, baptized him, and then took him back to jail. And then they hung him. Yeah, the morning of his execution. And Neil, after many more trials and retrials and appeals and shit, he was finally executed March 1885. So over 3 years after the initial case. And Neil's last words were recorded. "My friends,
that's one small step for man.
One giant leap for Snap."
God damn.
God damn. Neil's last words were, "My friends, I say to you, one and all, you know that this is no place to tell a lie. I stand here today to suffer for a heinous crime I did not commit. One day,
but how about that airplane food, guys?"
God damn it, I'm trying to cultivate mystique.
I'm sorry.
So Neil's last
words. No justice for you.
Okay. God damn it. Fuckers. "One day my innocence will be established beyond a doubt. I bid you, one and all, goodbye. O Lord, thou knowest I am innocent. Into thy hands I commit my soul. I am innocent." And they dropped the trap on him before he could finish the word innocent.
Sorry, Mr. Trump, your 90 seconds are up.
So yeah, that's the Ashland tragedy of 1881.
Thank you, I guess. Anyway, all right, calling in on the Podcast 1289 red phone, we've got Grant joining us now, everybody.
The red phone is a direct line to me.
It is. It's the Grant phone. It links directly to the Grant cave. So my story is, mine was in my county, but it was not in my town. It happened the next town over. In November 1971, this guy named John List, he lived in this big mansion in Westfield. Everyone thought he was loaded because this was literally the biggest house in the neighborhood. Well, it turns out he wasn't. This guy couldn't hold down a job. He was an accountant, and he was constantly getting fired because this guy was a fucking weirdo. He was uptight. He was not sociable. He was not polite. He was a very cold person. Well, he was so uptight and cold that when he would get fired, he couldn't bear to tell his wife or his kids or his mother, who all lived in the house with him, that he had been fired. So, like, while he was between jobs, which was often, he would get up in the morning, put on a suit and a tie, and then leave and sit at a train station or a bus stop just reading all day until 5 o'clock and then go home. So his family thought that he was at work. I'm pretty sure that's where the movie Falling Down with Michael Douglas got a lot of their ideas. So, finally, in November 71, this guy just snaps. He's got no money. He's $10,000 in debt. He was skimming off of his mother's Social Security checks because she moved in at one point, and even that wasn't cutting it. Oh, and another thing was his oldest child, Patricia List, who was 16. She started dabbling in occultism, started telling people that she was a witch and shit, and then...
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and then told her dad that she wanted to pursue a career in Hollywood as an actress. Now, of course, for him, this repressed Christian nutcase, he could not handle this. So he decided one day that the best way to save the family from guilt and the shame of poverty and all this stuff, which is where they were directly heading, the bank was actually initiating repossession paperwork at the time that this all happened. So within a month, they were going to lose the house. So he decided to spare them from all this, plus the shame of having a Hollywood actress in the family. He decided to shoot them all. Shot them all dead one morning. What he later said was that his motives were, well, I was making sure that they would go to heaven because they were spared from sin. So he just shot them all. He shot his wife while she was having her morning breakfast, walked upstairs to his mother's third floor apartment and shot her dead, and then picked off the kids one by one as they came home from school. And he cooked himself a dinner, spent one final night in this house, and packed up and left and disappeared for the next 19 years.
So you said he shot her during breakfast?
Yep.
My question is, did she Lego her ego?
I didn't want to laugh at that.
That's when the detective comes in. He's like, she did not Lego her ego.
Okay, here's the part where everything's going to come full circle. In the early 90s, they made a TV movie about this case. And the guy that played Beretta played John List. That's a bit of irony right there.
A gun?
No, the actor that played Beretta on the TV show Beretta.
There's just a gun in, like, a suit?
Yes, yeah. Well, anyway, in that TV movie, the scene where the detective comes to the house and finds the bodies, the scene that Mike was just describing, that detective was played by none other than David Caruso. It's like, it appears she Legoed her ego. So yeah, he disappeared for the next 19 years. It took the cops a month to find the bodies because he prepared for this meticulously. He wrote letters to all of his kids' schools saying, we're going on an extended vacation to, I believe it was North Carolina. He said there was a sick relative and he wasn't sure when they would be returning. He left all the lights on in the house, which the neighbors didn't think was too weird at first because they figured, oh, they're going on vacation. You know, they want people to think they're home. Another thing that he did before he left was he turned the air conditioner down to 50. And he put all of the bodies in sleeping bags and brought them into the ballroom of the house. So basically, with the air conditioning so high, the bodies were pretty much preserved. There was no smell coming out of the house because the bodies were decomposing at a much slower rate. So finally, a month after the killings, Patricia List's drama teacher checked on the house because he was worried that the family hadn't been back for a month and knew that List's mother, who was, I think, 88, lived on the third floor. So neighbors saw him, like, peeking through the windows, thought he was a burglar, called the police. The police show up, and they're like, what are you doing here? And he's like, oh, I'm Ed Iliano. I'm Patricia's drama teacher. They said they would be back by now, and they're not. All the light bulbs have burned out in the house, and I know that there's a very elderly woman living upstairs. So the cops open the doors. They all go in, and they find the bodies. By this point, John List was gone. And for the next 19 years, he lived under an assumed name, Robert Clark, had a new job, and eventually had a new wife. And it wasn't until America's Most Wanted broadcast a segment about the case, and Frank Bender did one of the first age progression sculpts for broadcast on TV. So when this image of what an older John List might look like hit the airwaves, one of, quote-unquote, Robert Clark's neighbors recognized the face right away and called the police. They came to Robert Clark's job, arrested him, fingerprinted him and proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was John List, and he was brought back to New Jersey for trial in, I want to say, 89 or 90. I mean, this guy was the boogeyman for 2 decades. This happened when my parents were kids. It scared the shit out of everyone. This was 2 miles away from my house. No one knew if he was going to come back and kill more people. At first, there were rumors that this was part of some sort of satanic thing because the daughter was interested in witchcraft.
Man, they give Satan way too much credit.
They do.
It's always like, Satan ordered me to do this, Satan ordered me to do that. Like, you know, he doesn't fucking talk to you through your dog, man. Chill the fuck out.
And I was talking to Doyle about this one time. I was like, Satan's a fucking moron, man, and he spit his soda out. He's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, he is. I'm like, he's always doing these goofy little tricks and ploys and shit to get people's souls.
Yeah, dude. Like, he's such a little, like, punk.
All he's got to do is offer a free car, man. Go the fucking Oprah route. You'd be surprised how mediocre most people are. They would give that soul up. Just,
yo, you got to, like, murder all these babies. I'll give you a Prius. And I'm like,
what? A free Prius?
Yeah, point me to that fucking, like, nursery room.
He also looks really fat in that red leotard.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Way to body shame Satan. By the way.
A little negative, Mike.
So, yeah, he was put on trial. He was eventually found guilty on all accounts. Now, one of the big things about why he was found guilty was they were able to prove that this was planned meticulously, that it was first-degree murder. One interesting piece of evidence that showed how this was planned was a letter that John List left behind in his study that was addressed to his pastor, Reverend Eugene Redwinkle of Westfield's Redeemer Lutheran Church. So the letter read, and it's marked November 9th, 1971. Dear Pastor Redwinkle, I am very sorry to add this additional burden to your work. I know that what has been done is wrong from all that I have been taught, and that any reasons I might give will not make it right. But you are the one person that I know that, while not condoning this, will at least possibly understand why I had to do this. I wasn't earning anywhere near enough to support us. Everything I tried seemed to fall to pieces. True, we could have gone bankrupt and maybe gone on welfare, but that brings me to my next point. Knowing the type of location one would have to live in, plus the environment for the children, plus the effect on them knowing they were on welfare, was just more than I thought they could and would endure. I know that they were willing to cut back, but this involved a lot more than that. With Pat being so determined to get into acting, I was also fearful as what this might do to her continuing to be a Christian. I'm sure it wouldn't have helped. Well, now she's a fucking dead Christian, so... Also, with Helen not going to church, I knew this would harm the children eventually in their attendance. I had continued to hope that she would begin to come to church soon. But when I mentioned to her that Mr. Footsie wanted to pay her an elder's call, in parentheses, this is not a criticism of Ed, she just blew up and stated that she wanted her name taken off the church rolls. Again, this could have only given an adverse result for the children's continued attendance. So that is the sum of it. If any one of these had been the condition, we might have pulled through, but this was too much at last. I'm certain that all have gone to heaven now. If things had gone on, who knows if that would be the case. Of course, Mother got involved, because doing what I did to my family would have been a tremendous shock to her at this age. I'm afraid she would have had a heart attack and died, so I killed her.
That's a pretty big shock when you're dead.
Yeah, man.
Therefore, knowing that she is also a Christian, I felt it best that she be relieved of the troubles of this world that would have hit her. How kind of you. After it was all over, I said some prayers for them all, from the hymn book. That was the least I could do. No, you could have not killed them. That would have been really nice. Now, for the final arrangements. Helen and the children have all agreed that they would prefer to be cremated. Please see to it that the costs are kept low, because I'm a frugal murderer. For Mother... she has a plot at the Frankenmuth Church Cemetery. Please contact. And then he just lists, like, a whole bunch of people to contact, to let them know that his family's dead, because he killed them. Brutally. And then it goes on to, also, I don't know what will happen to the books and other personal things, because I'm on the run, because I murdered my whole family. But to the extent possible, I'd like for them to be distributed as you see fit. Some books might go into the school or church library. Yes, let's gather around the murderer's book. Children, let's turn to page... Oh, that one has blood on it. Turn to the next page. And now this is where it really gets into why he was found guilty of first-degree murder. Originally, I had planned this for November 1st, All Saints Day. What a hack. But travel arrangements were delayed. My escape was delayed. My fleeing from justice as a fugitive. Because I killed my family. Brutally. I thought it would be an appropriate day for them to get to heaven. Again, because I killed them. In cold blood.
You're coming up all high and mighty like you've never wanted to murder your whole family.
I haven't. But, you should probably talk to some people. Maybe take something for that. So anyway, as for me, please let me be dropped from the congregation rolls as I am on the run for being a brutal murderer. Since I killed my family. I leave myself in the hands of God's justice and mercy. I don't doubt that he is able to help us, but apparently he saw fit not to answer my prayers the way I hoped they would be answered. Dude, you're writing a murder confession note because you killed your family. Getting passive-aggressive with God isn't going to make a priest feel sorry for you.
Isn't God really passive-aggressive, though?
Yeah, but I mean, Christians aren't supposed to acknowledge that. This makes me think that perhaps it was for the best as far as the children's souls are concerned. I know that many will only look at the additional years that they could have lived, but if finally they were no longer Christians, what would be gained? What a piece of shit. Also, I'm sure many will say, how could anyone do such a horrible thing? And they would be right to say that because you shot and killed your entire family because you couldn't keep a job and you're like a crazy Christian. My only answer is it isn't easy and was only done after much thought. Then there's some stuff on which pastors to contact and all that. And then he goes on to say, one other thing. It may seem cowardly to have always shot from behind, but I didn't want any of them to know, even at the last second, that I had to do this to them. John got hurt more because he seemed to struggle longer.
Oh my fucking God.
There were bullets entering his body, you know, because you were killing him. The rest were immediately out of pain. John, and probably is crossed out here, John probably didn't consciously feel anything either. No, he did, because he was struggling, because there were bullets in his body. Please remember me in your prayers. I will need them whether or not the government does its duty as it sees fit. I'm only concerned with making peace with God, and of this I am assured because of Christ dying even for me.
It sounds like trying to find a loophole.
And then John ended his letter to his pastor by writing, P.S. Mother is in the hallway in the attic, third floor. She was too heavy to move. John.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
What an asshole. He leaves a person and errand behind.
Well, that's basically what funeral arrangements are.
The sanctimonious hypocrisy of even leaving a letter with that tone while you go on the fucking run, right?
Yeah.
Like, if he were such a good fucking Christian, he'd turn himself in. But he didn't.
No. No, he didn't.
Well, if he was a good Christian, he wouldn't have murdered his entire family.
That's asking a lot, Mike.
Yeah. That's granted. Yeah.
That's granted. That's my new show coming to Fox this fall. I'm Grant. Get it? Play on words. I'm going to go get my dinner from the gas station, guys. I'll be right back. Yes. What year is this for, Loco? Yeah, it's got to let it breathe a little bit.
Is Grant still there?
Yes. I had to answer a text.
Yeah, so they found that piece of shit guilty, and he spent the rest of his life, 18 years, in prison until he died on March 21st, 2008, and his body lay unclaimed at a Middlesex County morgue. At some point, it was later claimed by persons unknown and was laid to rest next to his mother, who he murdered. And that's a tale of the Boogeyman of Westfield, folks.
Boogie.
That's yeah. Fucking
too spooky, too scary.
Another thing, that mansion where he lived and killed all of them and where they found the bodies, that burned down 9 months later. And at the time, people said that they never officially found out the cause of the fire, but
probably thought it best to not investigate.
Probably the devil.
My mom always told me, she was like, I'm convinced that the police burned it down because they were tired of kids breaking in.
I believe it.
Some of the newspapers from that time say that the rumor was that some teenagers had broken in and were holding a seance in the ballroom where the bodies were found, and someone knocked a candle over and started the fire.
You know, in hindsight, he probably would have fared better economically if he didn't own a mansion. Yeah, because, you know.
They owned a mansion, but there was, like, fucking nothing inside because they didn't have money for anything.
He must have got it, like, on a real big bargain, like.
No, not at all. the mother lived with them because he was just like, oh, well, you know, if you help me buy this mansion, you can come live in it. And he pretty much gave her the fucking attic to live in. It's like, I know you're 88 years old and you can barely walk and you've got that hip you're always complaining about, but listen, why don't you live 6 flights of stairs up? So, yeah, that's my story.
Oh, boy. That
sure was spoofy.
But not too spoofy.
Spooky, scary skeleton.
I'll be honest, I don't understand where the spoopy thing came from.
Nobody fucking does. Nobody understands. It just happened.
Just manifested.
Well, on that note, everybody have a happy Halloween from the crew of podcast 1289 people.
And parents, remember, drugs are expensive, so no one's just going to be giving them out to your children.
I got free drugs all the time when I was a kid.
Yeah, but you didn't get it going door-to-door trick-or-treating.
I was always told they put razor blades in my candy.
That was another thing, yeah.
They didn't give me candy when I went trick-or-treating. This gave me experience put on my resume.
I got it, John.
Internships.
Happy Halloweener.